And the fact is, it's the other way around. It's the other way around. Because every joy that we experience is a little shadow of the true joy. And the true joy is in God Himself. So every piece of joy we experience is true joy. Let's take the example of marriage. Does anybody by chance listen to This American Life on NPR? No big deal, but I listen to it from time to time. And yesterday there was the girl telling her story, and she told about the heartbreak that came to her through a broken relationship. And in their relationship, they were fans together of Phil Collins, the singer from the 80s and beyond, Genesis, drummer of Genesis, that's right. And so she actually, through some circumstances, had an interview with Phil Collins because she found she wasn't able to write a song that expressed the real pain that she was having. So she talked to Phil Collins about it a little bit, and a song came out of it, and Phil Collins explained that the pain that drives songs like Against All Odds. I'm not going to sing it for you. But it's a sad and painful song, and it's driven by real pain. Now, that song he wrote when his wife left with his kids. And he didn't say he was innocent, but he had lost his wife and he had lost his kids. And then another song he wrote in response to another wife leaving him on his birthday. And I'm seeing a pattern here that maybe even some of us can relate to. I'm not making fun at all. But what we're beginning to see is he's looking for something in marriage in the same way that this girl was looking for something in his relationship, in her relationship. What it is doing is it's creating a bunch of sad songs, but it's not working. It's not working. Now, why isn't it working? That's kind of the question for us. You see, somehow in there, promises were being made that weren't being kept. That's what was going on there, and I'm not even talking about unfaithfulness. I'm not even talking about overt sin in marriage like cheating and neglect. I'm talking about even something like turning marriage into what it's not supposed to be. Now that we've got the pain, let's look at how it works, or maybe we should say how it doesn't work. I started by saying that all joy is a shadow of the true joy which is in God. So joy that we would find in marriage is in some way reflecting God, and marriage is a reflection of the joy that is union with God. Okay? Jesus explains that He and the Father have a union, and that He has a union with us as His people when we trust Him as our Savior, when we enter into that relationship with Him, that there is a union in place there. And when we look around the world and see marriages in cultures, we're seeing a picture of that union. And when we are in that union ourselves in marriage and we're experiencing the joy that's resting ultimately on the union that is God bringing us into union with Himself. Okay? So that's what marriage is supposed to be. But what I'm sure Phil Collins does, and all of the rest of us are prone to do, is to make marriage the ultimate. To make marriage the source. To make marriage the object of our worship. Both in our longing for a marriage in the first place and in our demanding that marriage meets all of our needs. marriage is not designed to meet all of your needs. God meets all of your needs. Marriage is a wonderful gift, full of joy, reflecting God, but not for the purpose of meeting all of our needs. So on the movie screen, when he says, "You complete me," we see a recipe for disaster, because Tom Cruise, I think, is turning marriage into something marriage cannot be. It can't. Marriage makes the lie. See, anytime we're worshiping something in the place of God, we're sinning. We're creating an idol. So before, when I was talking about sin, you know, you were thinking of cussing, getting drunk, chewing tobacco, dating girls that chew tobacco, those kinds of things. But the stakes are much, much higher than that. You see, you take something very good like a marriage, and you elevate it to the place of God, and you have turned a good thing into a sin that is making lies. And it just can't do it. It just can't do it. So when you hear somebody say, "You complete me," you know that we have problems, because that's more weight than a person can bear. So we can look into the future and see tragedy, because it can't do it. Marriage can't do it. So Phil Collins enters a marriage, perhaps was completely faithful in every way, depending upon that marriage to give him his reason for living, and some partner is saying, "I can't take this. This is more than I was designed to bear," because you see what Phil Collins has done right there is he has turned his spouse into God. And she's not God. She's a creature. Just like Phil, just like me. She can't carry that weight. And so it crashes. So it's a distortion. So that's marriage. Adultery would be a different kind of distortion of the same kind of thing. Seeing dissatisfaction in marriage or excitement someplace else or for whatever reason, chasing after in a very distorted way that union with God that was really the source of joy. And obviously, the crash comes quicker and perhaps more violently in that scenario. So you see, if we're making the error of idolizing marriage or committing adultery, then we are settling for less than living water. See, the living water is found in Christ himself. Because marriage is good. But God is better. And marriage can't carry that. Marriage is very good when it's received as a gift from God. When marriage is made to be God, it's no longer good. It's just an idol at that point. So, we could run every sin we could think of through this little maze. And we would see that sin is distorting the reflection of the true God. Always. And that is why nothing but God satisfies. Nothing but God satisfies. Nothing but God has a chance of satisfying in a true and lasting way. So if we go through that list of things that we looked at earlier, things like satisfaction and fulfillment and meaning and identity, if we look for them anywhere but Jesus, we're going to be left empty. We're going to be left empty. Now there may be a moment of refreshment when you drink the water. There might be a moment of pleasure. And if you're really thirsty and you dip a cup into a dirty toilet, Ugh. But you know what? It's going to feel better for a second. In theory, I'm not going to testify that personally. But the point is, nothing that substitutes can do what the living water can do for us. It ends up with somebody in the front row saying, yuck. Okay. Because we'll always be thirsty again. Go back to John 4. They're having this conversation about the true nature of water, and Jesus asks the woman to fetch her husband. And at first we think, oh, he's changing the topic, but what he's doing is he's leading straight to her heart. The truth is, when we look at the text, she's had five husbands, and she's now with a man that's not her husband. She's been doing something very similar to what Phil Collins had been doing, looking for meaning, satisfaction, and fulfillment in marriage, sex, and intimacy. And while they all felt good, like the water, they all left her thirsty again. So she had to go get some more. Till she has to go to the water and to get the water in the heat of the day, because the respectable women won't allow her to be in their presence. That's what's going on in this passage. That's where it has ended up for her. So again, there's no doubt that there was real pleasure. There's no doubt that it really felt good. But it didn't last. It wasn't the real thing. It, as always, leaves her thirsting for more. That's what the math of her life says. Five husbands plus another man, still thirsty. As Tim Chester talked about that story, he gave these questions. What are the patterns in your life? Is there something in your life that has the words, if only, as a refrain? What comes after, if only? I would be, insert happy, content, okay, able to get through tomorrow, if only, what? See, as we make demands of that, if only, we're probably seeing the thing, very possibly a very good thing, that's making us promises it can't keep, because probably we've, the one that done it, have turned it into an idol. In verse 19 of our look at the woman at the well, she tries to draw Jesus into a controversial topic, and instead Jesus redefines worship. Jesus teaches that worship is not about location. It is an attitude of the heart. He says, you worship in spirit and truth. So we see that worship is about what we desire most. Worship is about what you think has the most worth. That's what worship is about. If you want to know what you worship what has the most worth to you. So every time we look to God and we satisfy our longings, we worship Him in spirit and truth. When we allow Him to satisfy our longings, when our longings are satisfied in God, we are worshiping. We are worshiping in spirit and we are worshiping in truth. Every time you look elsewhere, you commit idolatry. So when we look to God and worship Him, we worship in spirit and truth. When we worship something else, we're committing idolatry. See, it's easy for us to think of obedience as the price we pay for entry into heaven. like we talked about earlier. We get stuck in this trap that it would be better for me if I had the freedom to go pursue those other things that would make me feel good. But no, I'm stuck with God, who's making demands of me. See, that's the way the lie comes to us, inviting us to believe some promises that will never be kept. Might be kept in the moment, but can't be kept for the long term, and certainly cannot be kept through eternity. When God makes a promise, he keeps it forever. And then we begin to see that a life of obedience is really God just telling us that he loves us, that he wants us to protect us. He wants to protect us from things that will destroy us. He wants to preserve us for pleasure in him and in the gifts he's going to give us that we won't be able to enjoy if we've strayed outside of his moral will. So he's not stopping our pleasure. He's not stopping our fun. He's providing our pleasure. He's providing unspeakable pleasure by giving us something significant, by giving us a purpose that's significant, by giving us something worth dying for. Because when you have something worth dying for, you have something that's truly worth living for. And he gives us that. And he gives us a picture of what obedience looks like so we can walk that path with him and experience him. Experience this joy. So we see that God is not only better than anything that sin offers, God is forever. The Bible talks about the pleasures of sin. And there's no doubt that sins do bring pleasure. So we shouldn't pretend otherwise. But the Bible also tells us that the pleasures of sin are only for a short time. In the book of Hebrews, the writer talking about Moses says, this is chapter 11 of Hebrews, verse 24, "By faith, Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to be mistreated with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He considered the reproach of Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt. For he was looking to the reward." You see, God is asking us, God is calling us to look beyond the present moment and to use our eyes and look all the way into eternity. That's what he's inviting us to do. To not stop at this moment, but to look into eternity. We then see, as Paul says, the wages of sin is death. That's what Paul says in Romans 6:23. The wages of sin is death. So when sin makes us promises, it also comes with a price. There's always a price to pay. And that price is always death. And we experience some of those that price, some of those consequences, some of that death in this life, in the form of things like broken relationships and damaged bodies and a shamed conscience, maybe addictive habits, always consequences for the life to come. In James 1:15, James writes, "Sin, when it is full grown, alone gives birth to death. So the wages of sin is death. And I said there's always a price to pay, and that price is always death. Sounds kind of hopeless, right? Now, at this moment, it's important for us to step back and realize that is, we have not left the gospel. That truth is bringing us to bear down on the heart of the gospel. You see, at the heart of the gospel is death on a cross and life in rising again. That's what Jesus does. And you see, it's our sin that make the death on the cross necessary. You see, the wages of sin is death. There's always a price. And the very good news is the price is paid. The price is paid if we will trust Him. Now, if we don't value Him as the pearl of great price, if we don't see Him on the scales as being more valuable than the entire world, if we don't see Him as He is and trust Him for what He is offering us to do, then we're left to pay the price ourselves. To pay the price ourselves. Because the price has to be paid. The wages of sin is death. And that would mean eternity apart from God. The Bible calls that hell. The good news, though, is that the price has been paid. So we get to have eternity in union with God, experiencing that joy. It's the joy that the idolatry of marriage was distorting. We get to experience it for real. Not separation, but union. Even the promises that adultery is making, as it distorts in gross ways, we get to experience for real. And the joy of that union with Him forever. Because the price has been paid. And it has been paid. We probably have a tendency to look at the temptation. It's like, oh my, the temptation. It's so tempting. And Moses, in what we see from the writer of Hebrews here, he looked past the temptation. Okay, and we know that the Egyptians were wealthy. We can still see the pyramids and the Sphinxes. We know they were amazing. We know they were wealthy. We know that was as good as it got anywhere on earth at the time. If Robin Leach were still in business giving tours of the rich and famous, he would say, and here's the house of Pharaoh and the pyramid he's going to live in one day. And all of the ancient people would watch their TVs and say, ooh, amazing. Okay, that's the pleasure that Moses turned his back on. He gave it all up. He chose to be ill-treated with the Hebrew slaves. Why would he do that? Because he recognized that Jesus Christ was better than all that. Interestingly, the Egyptian pharaohs locked up their treasures in pyramids in an attempt to take it with them to the afterlife, because they had a little eternal perspective as well. Like, oh, this life wasn't enough for us. I'm going to take it all with me. You know where it is? It's in museums. You can even go to the art museum in Forest Park and see a relative of a pharaoh, if not a pharaoh of himself. It's there on display. So See, they tried to get what God would have been offering them if they'd have known him. And instead, they got to show off their stuff in a museum. See, they were believing lies. Stuff was making them promises. They were believing the promises, but the stuff wasn't keeping the promise. So now we get to see stuff in a museum. Because stuff can't keep its promises. Moses was not looking that way. He instead was looking to his reward of eternity with his God. Or the reward of God himself. So, Moses could see that God offered for all eternity something far better. Far better than anything sin could offer in this life. So, we see that in knowing God and in nowhere else, we find lasting fulfillment, satisfaction, joy, and identity. You know, with all that in mind, we can go back to Psalm 34. Verse 8, he says, "Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man who takes refuge in him." And then in Proverbs 24, 13 and 14, the teacher says, "My son, eat honey, for it is good. And the drippings of honeycomb are sweet to your taste." He says, "See that honey? Eat it. It's good. It is good. Now don't go making honey your source. That would be a mistake." But the writer wants his son to know that honey is in fact good, and then he explains why. He says, "Know that wisdom is such to your soul." He says, "The way your tongue lacks honey, wisdom is that way. It's that sweet for your soul. If you find it, there will be a future, and your hope will not be cut off." Through the book of Proverbs, we begin to see that wisdom is a personification for God himself. So the writer, as he's giving instruction to his son, is saying, "Hey, you know how sweet honey is? God is better." So God is good. God is better. And because of that, we don't have to look anyplace else.